Hi, and welcome everyone to a new episode of the CASE podcast, Conversations about Software Engineering. It's my pleasure to host this session today. My name is Alex Heusingfeld. I'm with Sven Johann and Heinrich Hartmann. And today, I'm very happy to have Mirko Novakovic with us. Mirko is a serial entrepreneur and investor. He started his career as a software engineer, became a freelancer for application performance before he co-founded Codecentric in Solingen. From Codecentric, he spinned off CenterDevice, he spinned off Instana, which was afterwards bought by IBM, end of 2020. And turns out that just being an investor wasn't sufficient for Mirko, seemingly. So you started Dash Zero. Mirko, a warm welcome to the show. Great to have you. Is there anything that you would like to add by yourself to your introduction?
Yeah, hi everyone, and thanks for having me on the show. No, I think it's a good summary. I in between Instana and Dash Zero, I also opened a few restaurants and invested in an olive oil farm. So a few things that were outside of software, but I'm glad being back.
And the wine, is it olive oil? Okay, because I thought it's olives, and you said, oh, which kind of olives should you buy? And then it's usually
olive oil, and the olives for olive oil that we use, you can't really eat. So it's really for oil. It's different.
Okay.
We also sell olives in glasses to eat, but it's actually not our olives. It's Kalamata olives. So our are from an island of Lesbos.
Okay. So what makes a good olive oil for you, Mirko?
At the end of the day, I had no idea of olive oil, right? So at the end of the day, it's really the olives. It's that simple, right? And harvesting them at the right time and sorting out the bad ones. And then the only thing you do is you press them, right? And you have to be careful with the temperature. That's the cold pressed. It's somewhere, I don't know exactly, between 20, 24 degrees Celsius. That's the temperature, and then you press them, and that's it, done. There's nothing you add to the oil. There's nothing you can really do. So it's really about the olives.
But as a consumer, like, what do you watch out for if you are like shopping olive oils or testing olive oils?
I think one of the things I learned is that you should look at the origin of the oil, and the more specific it is, the better is it for you, for the consumer. So, for example, if you have olive oil that says olive oil from Italy, that doesn't mean a lot.
Yeah,
so makes probably sense. The olives are bought from everywhere around the world. But if you have an olive oil from, I don't know, a specific region, like in Lesbos, if you say it's olive oil from Lesbos, the olive has to be from Lesbos, right? So then you know that it is from a special region, from local farmers, and I think that's the best thing you can do. Basically, look at a very specific region, and then it's a taste, right? I think there's olive oil, good olive oil in Italy, in Spain, everywhere, but of course, ours is the best.
Always looking at the best performance.
Awesome. Exactly. Can we ask, like, are there any like transfer learnings you have from the olive oil making that kind of transfer to software, or is it more a recreational activity for you?
I can generally say that my whole experience in restaurants, olive farms, and everything, the thing I learned is that everything I learned before can't be applied to that business because especially the margins, the way you work, are so different, right? It's more about really low margins. The whole food industry, especially in Germany, has very low margins, right? In restaurants, but also if you sell in supermarkets. So it's all about cost control and very detailed cost control, right? Where in our businesses, in consulting or software, I mean, the margins are pretty high, and therefore you can deal with costs totally differently. And therefore you can also manage companies very differently, right? In terms of salaries, in terms of benefits, in terms of how you operate. So my learning was that everything I learned before is not a good way to approach a food business.
Yeah, so you had to unlearn probably a lot of things.
Exactly. And also, I lost a lot of money.
Okay. That means re-education. Okay. That's actually interesting. Like when you explained the process that actually all the quality is in the grapes of the olives, then that doesn't like one by one apply to software at all, right? Because like with software you have a very high change ratio that you can have. And with olives, it's like the trees are how old? Like
on Lesbos, they are hundreds of years old, actually. That's also something. It's a lot of olive trees and they are pretty old. Exactly, right? And you just have to wait and you can't do a lot, right? It's also very dependent of the weather, especially the overall olive. Also, the prices of olive oil is highly dependent, especially because of global warming. The past 2 years, the price almost doubled because Spain had such a drought, and Spain is the biggest producer of olive oil, that the overall olive oil market just exploded, right? From like around 5 euros per liter to 11.60, I think was the high. Mm. And now it was a good year. So the price is going down again, right? And it is positive and negative because for the farmers, it's actually pretty good if the price is high, because the farmers get more money for their oil. But for the consumer, a good olive oil these days is north of 20 euros a liter, right? Everything that's below, it's probably not good olive oil, because just the production cost is around 11.50, or what you pay for the farmer, right? So if you calculate it, it's very hard to be below 20 euros.
It's actually an interesting coincidence, because yesterday I was watching a report by some Spanish television company. They interviewed olive farmers in Spain because last year they had this drought, and then they had the flooding, and now they have drought again. But in some regions in Portugal, just this week, there is flooding again. So they are looking at different types of grapes, and I learned that there are over 700 different types, and they are thinking about mixing the genetics, and they are using large language models artificial intelligence to find out which grapes to cross. And they are also building up an IoT network at the moment to have sensors under each tree to understand what they can do in terms of most efficient watering, so to save as much water as possible.
But I have to say one thing that's true for olive trees and also for wine grapes. So in Lesbos, for example, the trees don't get water. And what happens is, if you have old trees who never get water, the roots go very deep and they can survive droughts. But if you water trees, they don't build out those roots and they can't survive droughts anymore, right? So it's kind of a complex topic of industrial production and watering and getting more grapes. But then if there's a drought and you don't have water, the trees can't survive anymore, right? But naturally, olive trees would survive a drought if they are not watered, right? So it's an interesting thing to look at these trees and grapes and all these things.
Sounds like a sustainability topic.
Yeah.
Okay. I actually wanted to start with interviewing you a little bit about the past path that you've come until now with Dash Zero. And I was thinking, is there a common theme that you would say that takes you from the very beginning, your interest in software engineering, towards your time as an investor, and then that led you into founding Dash Zero?
I don't know if there's a common theme. I think the common theme is that there are waves of technology innovations, right? When I finished studying, that was 99, I came into the internet bubble, right? And what that was really good for me, right? I was young. I came into projects where we built the first online banking for a German bank. And by doing that, I also experienced firsthand all the problems that you got, right? I remember we had we actually did the online brokerage for Dresdner Bank, and that and they did the IPO of T-Online, if you remember. And
they have this Corba implementation?
Yeah, it was Corba server. It was a weird technology from today's point of view, but especially. I remember when we started it and hundreds of users and thousands of users came, everything crashed, right? And we had this black box and we didn't know why it crashed. And that's how I came into the performance and troubleshooting space, right? Because I was there. I was the developer. I had to figure out how it works. So I figured out tools and implemented things like logging to figure out where it crashed. And then because I did it and I was one of the first at the time because it was new, I went to the second project where they knew I was inside of IBM and they knew, oh, there's this guy who troubleshooted this Dresdner Bank thing. Maybe he can help us with the TUI portal, right? And then I went there and then I went into the next one. And so I think it's always really cool to be one of the first in a new area or topic because you can just gain experience, which you just can't get that fast if you're not inside that wave, right? And then there were other waves, as you know. There was the mobile wave, then the whole cloud wave, microservices, and I would say now we have the AI, Gen AI wave, which is moving very fast. And whenever you are in the middle of such a wave, there's a ton of opportunities, right? Everything changes. The developer tools change, the infrastructure changes, the processes normally change, the way you work changes, everything changes, right? And whenever, like with Gen AI, it will be the same, right? There will be monitoring tools for Gen AI, there will be security tools, there will be new tools, new developer tools. And I think that's kind of a topic that is part of our industry, not only myself. And I think I'm very curious, right? I love to investigate these new things. And then I start thinking, okay, how can I basically monetize it? And because I am in the performance space for now 25 years or longer, that has always been my passion, right? So I always think like, okay, what does it mean for troubleshooting? What does it mean for monitoring? And that was always a common theme. When I founded CodeCentric, the initial CodeCentric was all about performance and troubleshooting, right? And then we did also software engineering and programming, but and then Instana was an APM tool for microservices because I saw, oh, there are these things called Docker containers, right? That works totally different than before. So we need something else, different agent technology. And now I saw the opportunity with OpenTelemetry, which is -0, a new standard, a lot of open sourcing in that space, new things coming up, LLMs. And yeah, so that's a common theme. I love the change in the industry, and I basically figured out that every time everything changes, right? From a database technology to, I'm not sure if I'm the older guys here, but when I started, it was a WebSphere application server with a DB2, right? That's not how you program these days, right? But everything changes. Exactly. And on the AIX and HPUX and Linux, nobody used, right? Open source was weird, right? Nobody used open source at that time, right? And then Linux started and then other open source. I mean, you know it. But so if you just look at the past 25 years, it changed a lot, right? And that's the fun part. And I think that's also the part where if you are eager to learn, I think that's the biggest thing as a software engineer or as a founder. You have to be open to learn, right? And unlearn all the things that you learned before, right? It's crazy, but just think about an IDE. I was an Eclipse user for a long time, right? And then if you use something like IntelliJ, you feel like you start from scratch, right? Because all the shortcuts do not work and it feels weird. But then after a few weeks, months, you get more productive. So it is this thing that you have to kind of love also this pain, right? Of starting from scratch all the time and figuring out things and going through this valley of not being as productive as before, but then coming out even more productive.
So the common theme would be you love to unlearn things, or actually love to learn how to do things in a different way, or look at it in a different perspective.
Yeah, and I just love learning, right? I think that's really, and I kind of, it sounds weird, but I kind of like the pain, right? it is really the situation. I don't know if you can second that, but if you do something and you have totally understood how it works, then it gets boring, right? I mean, I'm just not the guy who wants to build the 10th Spring application in the same way. There are people who love that, right? Who are really good at that, but I'm just not good at it, right? I'm bored, and then that also leads to problems, right? Because sometimes I would probably use a new technology, though it doesn't make sense, right? That's also a common theme in software engineering, that people just experiment to not get bored, but it's the nature of being curious and wanting to learn something.
Yeah, how do you look at the skill set of software engineers evolving, like from the 2000s era to now, specifically when it comes to like performance and debugging systems? I think like in the 2000s, like full stack understanding, also understanding how the operating system works, kind of being able to reason through the layers, has been like a critical skill set that I think like really sets you apart. And now it feels like with containers and Kubernetes and more like complexity along the stack, the skill set is becoming a little bit more horizontally focused. So how do you think about this, maybe also in this context of the current wave, which seems extremely like high level and extremely wasteful in some sense, but comes with its own challenges?
Mm-hmm. I'm really a big believer in fundamentals.
Yeah.
So I do think that learning frameworks and these things is nice, but I learned compilers and operating systems, and I think those things are really the fundamentals that help you whatever you do, especially in performance, right? Because at the end of the day, everything comes down to a few fundamental principles, and they actually, if you look back in 99 until today, they haven't really changed, right? I mean, there are a lot of fundamentals which are still pretty much the same. And if you understand them, then it is much easier for you to deal with problems, right? And to, I haven't programmed for, I don't know, probably, well, let me think, 15 years, right? So really hardcore programmed. But I can still understand most of the things because I can break them down into some fundamental principles, and I can understand what it means, right? I understand what a container is. I understand what Kubernetes does. I understand then what a Fargate does if it's serverless, or I understand new serverless technologies, how they work, because I understand fundamentals of databases and file access and these things. So I do think if you understand fundamentals, it is much easier to understand larger concepts too, right? And my son just started studying in Munich, and they do assembler and microcontroller programming. Mm. I think it's a super cool idea, right?
Yeah.
It's really good that they understand what microcontrollers are, what registers are, and I think that's, I thought they wouldn't do it, but I really think that's good, right? They still do it. Assembler, C, compilers, and I think that's the right thing to do, right? If you have those fundamentals, you can learn everything, right?
Yeah, Gunter Dück, he is also talking about this constantly, that you don't want to have, you know, the latest trend at university, because the trend is gone in 5 years. Absolutely. And then, you know, the trend stuff.
I also think it's a different topic, but that's my biggest kind of, when I think about AI and AI coding or supporting a large part of the coding, I really think that it can be hard for some developers, because then they will be even further away from the fundamentals, right? You just type in some prompts and some code will be generated. And depending on how this will evolve, we will have a generation of developers who have no idea of code anymore. And that can be really challenging in situations where you have to troubleshoot, where you have to understand what's happening, right? So I think that's something why I really think it's good to still do the fundamentals, even though AI could generate 80% of the code, right? That doesn't help you in situations where you have to really deeply understand what's going on.
Yeah, the funny thing is there is actually a study. Not sure who did the study. I need to look it up. But I mean, not surprisingly, the study found out that if you're a bad developer, considered a bad developer, and you use AI as your coding assistant, you produce just more bad code. And if you're a good developer, whatever that means in that study, you produce good code. Yeah. So yeah, it's you just cannot abstract away a lot of things. It's just you have to know how it works.
Absolutely. But it's interesting. I had this discussion once with a Netflix engineer. I unfortunately forgot his name. He said the engineers these days, and it was in I think 2015, he said the engineers these days they don't actually know how the kernel works and how it actually addresses the CPU cycles, and that they are messing up completely because of the wait time that they are implying. And I was like, we're already talking about like the rise of containers. I think it was the early days of Docker Swarm, but I might be wrong. I know that Google was already working on the predecessor of Kubernetes. And I was like, well, the people are so focused on their containers and what happens inside their containers. And then you say, well, we have container orchestration. And to me, container orchestration in the meantime, even more than back then, feels like the new application, Java application servers, who try to do everything for you and abstract away all the system limitations. And especially on the Java application service, I was always thinking, okay, but what really happens in the background? Because when the JVM does the full stop, then
yeah,
like what happens, right? What happens to my user requests? And he was like, yeah, but you have to understand it. What would you say? What level of depth is the basic that you have to understand, and what is it that you should be able to rely on the platform to tell you a certain signal? Like, to be maybe more specific, I was saying, well, if I'm using the kernel wrong inside a container, the question is, how would I even know without like doing kernel debugging? And how would I do this on a container orchestration?
I mean, it's really hard to say, right? Again, I'm pretty curious. And in the observability space, for example, there are technologies that are evolving right now called eBPF, which essentially is some sort of kernel debugging, right? So you are inside of the kernel and kind of a virtual machine inside of the kernel where all the events that happen come in, like a call of a function, right? Or a call to a file or to network, right? And if you do it right, if you filter it right, you can basically create an agent which then understands how containers communicate over a network on the machine, right? Because you are investigating the messages inside of the kernel. So I like to read those books and understand the technology because I want to understand what does it mean for me? What does it mean for my industry? I would try it, right? I would try it out. And I think this curiosity would help every developer, right? Understanding better what you can do. But then there's also the topic that there's a lot of things I have absolutely no idea of, right? Because you can't go deep on everything, right? That's also the reality. And you can go really deep on the Java virtual machine. You can go really deep. I mean, I'm not programming for 15 years, but I was really good at optimizing garbage collector and heap sizes back then there were probably 100 different parameters, how you depending on the garbage collector algorithm, how you size the different generations of the heap and all these things. I loved it, right? And but not every developer probably would do that, right? So you need some, like the T-shape, right? You need some, I think it's always good if you are really good at in some things and then have a very broad understanding of a lot of things, right? I think that's this thing that's, I think, called T-shape. I think that's pretty good, but you can't be deep on everything. I mean, there are some people, I'm not that smart. I'm really sometimes talking to people and I'm like, oh my God, he's deep in everything, right? I think I can't do that. So I always focus on certain topics which are in my interest. So performance optimization, monitoring, and I try to catch up with everything that's happening there, right? Just because I also enjoy it. And I also have a fundamental knowledge of a lot of things. So it's easier for me to stack up more knowledge, right? But then there are areas where I probably have absolutely no idea, right? Like mobile phone development, I've never touched, right? I know nothing about mobile phone development, right? Essentially. So that's a topic I never really had interest, right? As an example. So, but other things I'm really interested in, right? So I don't know if there's good or bad, right? But for me, it always helped to be good in a few certain things, right? And not being so good in others, right?
I had to look up the name of the guy because I think I know the Netflix guy. Just as a little input, you probably meant Brendan Craig.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has some really good. I've read all his books, right? He's has some really good books about hardcore performance analytics.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I love those books, right? And he has also some really good methodologies, right? How to profile things, how to analyze things.
Yeah.
So a lot of good fundamentals which you can learn from. Yes, but Brendan is, he's a.
It's a rock star.
Rock star in that space.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, then again, if you have people like him or Markus Lagergren, it's, you very soon, very quickly understand that, they are experts in their field. And I rather refer to them instead of trying to go as deep as they are in terms of understanding.
And by the way, that's something, if you are a young engineer or something, I would say, what is the difference between Brendan Craig and, I don't know, someone at a normal company in Germany, for example, right? And the big difference is that he had the chance to learn an environment which had extremely crazy requirements, right? Mm-hmm. Netflix, right? It's kind of luck. Also being in those kind of environments, if you would be one of the first Google engineers and you would have to scale that, you would probably have learned things that you can't learn if you are working at a bank, right? Just because you don't have that requirement to handle 1 billion users and or have a Netflix which streams 100 millions and should react in 10 milliseconds, right? I mean, these are just requirements that probably require you to go very deep in certain topics, right? Which you just don't have to in others, right? That's...
Yeah. Brendan moving to Netflix, I think, was one of the best things that happens to Linux observability in the last 10 years. He was kind of working on the Solaris kernel for a long time. I think he had big contributions to Dtrace. And when he moved to the Linux stack, he was for the first time, oh, what the hell is this going to be here? And he had this great talks on how broken all the Linux tools are. And then he mapped out like observability in Linux and identified also eBPF as the technology that is going to bring the advantages. And then we saw like BPF Trace and this kind of Dtrace-like tools also break into Linux land and kind of really advance the industry quite a bit.
And Adrian Colcraft was also at Netflix, by the way. He was one of the initial Dtrace developers on Solaris, right? I think that's a team from Solaris going to Netflix. And but you can see, I like having this deep knowledge on a Solaris operating system, then moving to something like Netflix or a company like Netflix, then you can apply your knowledge, right? And that's, yeah, I mean, it's also luck to be at a company like Solaris and then being at a company like Netflix, right?
Yeah, exactly. And this is a little bit of my learning. I came from a company that was very performance focused and was also running Solaris for these reasons. And then going to a German e-commerce company, it was like, there was really no market for Dtrace. There was really no market for like detailed syscall profiling or stuff like this. We only have one or two applications where which are really performance critical, and there some engineers have figured this out. But the average engineer wouldn't touch the kernel at all, wouldn't go so deep. It will be more, okay, are we shaving off 100 milliseconds here? Are we shaving off 100 milliseconds there? Rarely some garbage collection issues, but it's more like higher up the stack. And I think this question about skill set and proficiency, you can ask this about the personal career, where it's like, okay, how do you want to develop? And also, how do you complement your day-to-day skill set with just like deeper skills, which will indirectly inform? But there's also this question about like engineering a platform. So as a steward of the overall developer population, or as an owner of the platform, how do you develop the tool set in a way that also shapes the skill set and supports the skill set of the developers? Like, are you offering trainings in certain areas? Are you buying tools that go in a certain area? And I was like thinking about, like, for example, continuous profiling or more advanced tools that kind of go into the kernel in that context. And I think what we are seeing is that they are at the moment not really crazy successful. It's really the stuff that is higher up the stack. And then there's a question, how low are we actually getting? And at which point do you switch the tool and so on? So having developed at least two observability solutions, like, what is your take on this? How would you anchor the stories? And like, what is like the conscious choices that you make? Okay, we're not going there.
I mean, I can just give you a rough estimate from how the market in terms of revenue is doing at the moment overall, right? And then we can discuss why, right? So if you look at the market, probably 50% of the observability space is metrics and dashboards. Yeah. Then around 30% is logs. And then around 10% is traces. And the last 10% is the rest. And that includes real user monitoring, synthetic monitoring, profiling, everything, right? Everything. Yeah. So it is really a lot of metrics, right? A lot of logs, a bit of tracing. I'm a really big trace fan, right? I love tracing, but the reality is, and we see that with inside of our customer base, we saw that at Instana, and I know revenues from companies like Datadog. It's always the same shape, basically, right? It is developers come in, or SREs, they first build some dashboards with some metrics, right? And then if they want to debug something, the first choice is normally logs. I log something somewhere, and then I put in my own messages that I can find. And then if you are already advanced, you use tracing, which is, if you talk about low-level kernel tracing, this is the different. This is like the DEPA paper from Google, right? This is microservice tracing, what I'm talking about. So very high level still, giving you ideas of which servers are wrong. Then profiling, almost nobody uses, right? it's already a tool that's not used a lot, and it looks like, and I'm saying this also as a, it looks like, and I had to learn this also in the past 10 years, because my way of thinking was always, oh, I need to provide these deep insights. But it looks like that 90%, I would say, of the developers are not interested in that. And they also don't need it, right? And that's just the reality of the market. And that's what I learned in the past 10 years. And you really have to provide, I would say, these basic use cases in a very easy way and a very accessible way to be successful, right? I would say Datadog, who is the I would say, the most successful company in this space at the moment, right? It's changing over time, right? If you look in the past 20 years, there was always, but at the moment, I would say it has the largest market cap. It's the fastest growing company. So I would say they are the clear number one at the moment. So if you look at them, they really manage to give you, I don't know, 80% of the value with 20% of the functionality in a pretty easy way, right? And that seems to be the winning way of doing it. And then there are other tools which are very, very deep, right? And provide you with very deep profiling tools, for continuous profiling tools, for example, which for some use case, if you are a database developer, right? You probably need that, right? Because you still have to, but the normal applications these days, it doesn't seem to be a problem anymore, right? Because, and let's face it, resources are super cheap, super cheap. I mean, if you look at what CPUs or a storage S3 costs, it's literally nothing, right? So, I mean, I give you one story which was mind blowing for me, and you will probably get that. But I look at these days how we, for example, search in logs, right? If you store logs, we store logs in S3, and if you search for them, we literally, there's no index. We go through all the logs and look at them. Right? Even if there are billions of them, and the way you do it is like a little bit like a map reduce, right? You use a function, spin up, you take, you cut the logs into 100 buckets, and then you have a function for each bucket, and then you merge the result together, right? But like looking 20 years back, it would be absolutely ridiculous doing that, right? Because disk was so slow, it was super expensive doing this. So you use something like an index, right? To index these things, have that index in memory. I'm just saying, things change, and something that was super obvious that if you don't have an index on a database, you can't really be fast. It's not true anymore, right? And the reason for that is that resources have become so cheap that you can do it differently.
I must say, I had to laugh. My previous company, they co-founded Elasticsearch. And at that time, Elasticsearch was a search engine.
Yeah.
And then the whole Logstash-Kibana thing showed up. And we were all like, yeah, I mean, index-based logging, that's the thing to do. It's so cool. We were woof. And then that was 2012 when Elasticsearch has been founded. And then another part of the company, you probably know those guys, Gita Schmidt and Kresten Grabtaub.
Yeah, Humio.
Humio, they founded Humio and they said, no index no more.
Index free, yeah, exactly.
It's like, it's a stupid idea, you know, don't do this. It's
Kresten.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Who has also, we talked about this butcher farming, he is also a farmer now.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
No, exactly, but you can see how things change, right? And I think that's exactly in a space where you go, this is something that is 2012, probably it was pretty hip until 15, 16, 17. Humio was founded 15, 16, and then it took a while. So probably you have like one technology, and then also when it's in production, I mean, we used Elastic at Instana at the beginning, right? And at some point it becomes horrible, right? Because if you have to scale the cluster, you have to re-index, rebalance things. It costs time. It's a heavyweight process. It doesn't scale as you like, right? So you then figure out, oh, okay, index, maybe it has also some downsides, right? And then you see something like Humio, which is index free, and you say, oh, this is cool. You can scale it up easier, right? And then next day, Lambdas come up, right? And there's a new serverless thing, and you can do it again differently, right? So I talked to Kresten a few weeks ago, and he told me that he is like researching and looking. He said, okay, these days you could build a Humio 10x faster and better, and because there's this new technology and there's this cool new thing. So this said, this is the cool thing about our industry, right? Overall, that every five, as I said initially, every 5 to 10 years, things change. And that's a huge opportunity because you can reduce costs, you can be faster, do something different, right? That's the cool thing.
At the same time, I see a lot of engineers when they are in trouble, they stick to the tool belt that they always had. And most of them don't update their tool belts. And when you just said like 50% of the observability market is metrics, I was thinking, yeah, of course, because we know which metrics we want to look at, right?
Exactly. And because we are also good, one thing I learned is we are also good looking at charts. If you have ever done it, if you put a dashboard in your, I know that exactly also, as if you are a developer, you know exactly what I mean, right? You put a dashboard and you look at it every day, and then you look at it and you think, oh, something is wrong. You see it directly because your brain knows what normal looks like. And then if something is, even if somebody else would look at it, they would just say, how could you do that, right? Because you are really good at looking at charts. And the chart is actually a representation of probably millions of data points in a visual representation. And our brain is just really good at looking at these visual presentations.
Yeah.
And also, by the way, one thing that's not that obvious, because that's one of the reasons why at the moment LLMs are not really good at these things, because they would look at the data and the abstraction, the chart, works much better, right?
Yeah.
And I think at one point, if we train models to look at charts, not at the underlying data, I think they can maybe become as good as we are. But we have looked at different algorithms. Most of the algorithms take the chart and transform them into data again, and then look at the data. So, but I think you should really just look at the chart, right? Because you see anti-patterns and patterns very good in these charts, right? I think that's why metrics and dashboards work so well, because we are really good at looking at millions of data points by just looking at some nice colored bar charts or something like that.
Another very interesting aspect about dashboards, and they didn't get a lot of love these days, I feel, at least in the conference realm, is that they are a really good way to communicate conceptual models about software.
Yeah.
Like working on a Linux kind of use dashboard where all the resources are like structured. I learned we don't have error metrics for a lot of the stuff that we actually run. So it's actually like fairly poorly covered with telemetry part of there. And then similarly, like producing a Postgres dashboard, what are the components you have to be aware of? Building this, I learned a lot, but also looking at charts that others built, which were really principled, really helped my understanding of the architecture and the operational concerns very significantly.
Yeah. Absolutely. But I also agree with Alex that it's kind of also because we do this because we are just used to it. Right. But there's one thing you mentioned, I also did center device, right? And I learned a big lesson there, because center device was something like a file system, shared file system in the cloud, something like Dropbox, right? And one day I came to the conclusion that I hate folders.
Yeah.
Right? Because I thought folders is a very stupid concept, right? Because you have a file and it's one folder. And I said, yeah, but I sometimes have file which I want to have in six folders, right? Because it is text relevant. So I want it in the text folder, but it's also relevant for my house. So I want it in my house folder, and it's relevant for my bank account, right? And so I said, it's much smarter to just tag them, right? Just have a file, you put it in, and then it's tagged, probably even auto tagged. And then I can just use the tags, right? So I built this tool. And what I figured out is, and there is this book called Don't Make Me Think.
Yeah.
It's the same when Windows removed the Explorer. If you are so used to structuring things with files, it is super hard to change the behavior of users, right? Same for example, I use Google Mail for 15 years. I don't have a single folder, right? I can find everything with a search. Sometimes I tag something, but then there are still the Outlook users who have these large folders, and every email gets into a folder. It's just, I think changing behavior of users is super hard, and building a company on the idea that you will basically retrain the way a user works is pretty dangerous, because there's a high chance that this will fail, right? Not because it's a wrong concept, just because it takes probably decades to retrain people, right?
And that was the point that I was trying to make, Mirko, because just because there are new technologies, and I'm especially looking at Humio, for example, doesn't mean that people will adopt the product, because if they have to behave differently in order to utilize the benefits, then it will be a very steep learning curve, like a steep entry point. And yep. that's really something that I'm wondering these days a lot about. It's like this willingness to change is based on the understanding that I cannot stay the way I am.
Absolutely. I have a very simple pattern, right? And you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I always say change only happens with pain, right? If there is no pain, you will not change. You don't change. And this was when I was at Concentric, we introduced Agile, right? And if there was no pain with your waterfall model, you would never go with Agile, right? I mean, real pain, right? You have to experience it and then you have to solve. And it's the same here, right? If you, for example, with Humio, if you don't have the pain of very large data sets, for example, but I know that Humio had very, very large clients at the beginning, right? Like I think Bloomberg was one of their biggest customers and a referenceable one. And they had, I don't know, billions of logs, right? And then, as I said, the whole thing of index failed, right? Because you had to rebalance all the time and it was not working. So they had to find something that was working for them. And so Humio had a solution. So they changed because they had the pain of having too much logs for their index, right? If you have a logging system and Elastic worked with an index, why would you do it differently, right? You don't have the pain to change, right? Then you probably do something else first because that's the pain, right? I think that's kind of the way I think, right? By the way, COVID was the best example, right? Nobody ever wanted to do home office and everyone said, we can't do it. We don't have VPNs. And then it was stay at home. And even the most traditional German companies managed to become a remote only company in whatever, a week or a month, right? Which was absolutely crazy. If you think about, if you would go to one of those companies before COVID and you said, you have to implement remote, the IT would say, oh no, VPN, that's no too way. Complicated. No way, we can't do this. So if there is pain,
we'll pay all the laptops.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you have pain, which in COVID was obvious, right? All my employees at home, they can't come. Then you're ready for the change, right? And I think that's what I learned in the past. If there is no pain, there's no change.
All right. Let's say if the pain is not felt yet, because it could be that there will be pain in the future and you see it, and that's basically the same like smoking, right? You know that it's not great for your body, but if you don't feel the pain right now that you will have afterwards, you might change only when it's already too late. And that is a big question, as I said. I'm wrapping my head around that these days quite a lot, because the thing that I see necessary for our industry is the speed of change. For a lot of companies, the necessity to change very quickly will become a lifesaver or like a matter of their extinction. And I don't think that every company has understood that yet, like how fast they have to move in the future, how fast they have to iterate and innovate. And that's a pity.
It's true, but I also learned something else, and that is that I always overestimated the need for change all the time, right? I was always like, always, right? Always under, or there are a lot of industries where slowness is not such a disadvantage, right? And that's what I want to say is, like, for example, I was working for insurance companies, right? And I always said, oh, if you don't become a 100% online company, then you will be gone, right? turns out highly regulated market. I think almost no insurance company is really digital yet, and they still all survive and have better and better results. Car industry is another example, right? I had a Jux keynote in 2014 where I said, if the German car companies don't become software companies and electrical, they will be gone in 5 years. So 2019. Now it's 2025. They still have shitty software systems in the cars. They still don't really have electrical cars, but still they have record earnings, right? So it's, I know that there is a chance, but I think I always still, even if you ask me today, I would say, oh, there's a high chance that they will be gone in 5 years. The reality is probably in 5 years, they will still be there, still be very powerful because they have a brand name and they will adopt. They could have been 15 years faster, but I agree with you totally. I think we have to change radically everywhere, right? And be more digital and becoming rapid in change. I'm just saying it's also a little bit learning from me that a lot of people are just not that fast with change. Yeah. And you can see that that helps also companies, right? Because the customers also don't change, right? You can see that people are still buying diesel, right? And other things. Though everyone should know that this is old technology now, right?
And talking about old technology and new technology, you just mentioned the waves that are ongoing and AI and the rise of open telemetry. So how do you explain the benefits of this to your new customers now if they don't feel the need to change?
It's a very good question, but the really positive thing I'm seeing at the moment in the market, but also talking to customers, that they understand this without me even telling them. So the adoption rate of open telemetry is really high. It has become, I think a few weeks ago, it became the number one project on CNCF. It overtook Kubernetes in the number, I think, of commits or something. It is a very active project. And I think there are many reasons why people experience that. Number one is lock in with vendors and the way vendors use that lock in to negotiate prices, right? And so, I mean, there was this big post on I don't know where I read it, on X somewhere, that I think Coinbase paid $60 million a year to Datadog, which was like everybody was like, what, $60 million for observability a year, right? And that was kind of the beginning of a discussion: is that a fair price? What should I pay? And but once you are locked in with proprietary technology, it gets really hard switching. So open telemetry for the first time in the observability history, basically, is an open source platform with agents that allow you to get all the data you need vendor independent, right? And I think that's what a lot of customers understood. And I always say it's probably the last agent you will ever install, right? Because that's the only one you will need. And there was a second thing which they did pretty well, and this is the standardization of the metadata of telemetry, which is the semantic convention. And that is a super powerful tool. You have to understand a little bit how this works, but I always explain, if you give 10 developers the task to name the tag of a host name, right? So there's a host name, and you give 10 developers, they will decide for the tag name. There's a high chance that you at least have 8 different versions of the name of the tag, right? Server name, server underscore name, host underscore name, host dot name, right? And what OpenTelemetry did, they standardized that tagging system. And so now it's host dot name. And what does it mean? That's why it's called semantic. Now you have semantics, right? Now you get a tag and it's not anymore a piece of text. It is actually an understanding for a tool that this is a host name, and now you can do things with it, right? You can map it to a host map, right? You can correlate things, CPU of that host with something else, right? If a log from that host comes, you know that it actually happened on that host, right? Same is true for Kubernetes pod name. So the semantic convention, that's actually why I founded Dash Zero, right? I saw the semantic convention, I saw like, oh my God, this is so cool, right? Because now I can get data from different sources. It could be from a cloud vendor, from a second party tool that I'm using, but I can still understand everything they sent me because I have hundreds of specified tags that I can now semantically understand, right? And this is what we built the tool around, having a context, having a semantical understanding of the data, and that makes it super different, right? Now a log is not only a log, it has a resource attached, it has context, it has a connection to a trace, to a server, to a pod, to a Kubernetes cluster, to a cloud, and it makes the usability totally different. Yeah. So I think it's a really, really good standard. It took 5 years to get there, right? Like good standards always take some time, right? But now it's pretty stable, at least for the core telemetry data for logs, traces, and metrics. Now there's also profiling and RUM. This is not yet stable, right? Will take some time. But for the core telemetry data, I think it's really good.
So I guess most of the big industry players have stake in OpenTelemetry and send developers to work on it.
Absolutely. I think the big cloud vendors did, AWS, Microsoft, Google, though the adoption is lagging a bit, right? And it's always, also, I mean, for vendors, it's also always a thing of, I would say, the innovator's dilemma, right? Think about you are AWS and you have a log service with your own logging system. And that's probably, there's no numbers on these systems, but I guess that actually not Datadog is the one that's the largest. Probably it's one of the cloud vendors, right? Probably AWS is bigger on observability in terms of revenue than a lot of the vendors. And so they are also very careful in adopting those standards because that gives you the ability to go to something else, right? So. Mm-hmm. I think the innovator's dilemma that you basically churn your own revenue is always a problem in adoption, right? But you can definitely see that all of them are adopting it. All of them spend a lot of resources in the open source community, right? AWS, the vendors, Datadog, Elastic, Grafana, Honeycomb, all the vendors, right? They spend a lot of time there, a lot of resources, and I don't think there's a way around OpenTelemetry anymore, right? So if you start from scratch these days, I think it would be a mistake not going on OpenTelemetry.
Can you talk a little bit about how you position Dash Zero like overall in the landscape? I think the semantic convention is definitely super interesting technological like innovation and opens up new possibilities. But like, if you zoom out a little bit, you see maybe Datadog, you see Grafana, you also see Instana positioned. And I'm sure you kind of saw a gap where you have a value proposition that is appealing. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Absolutely. So I have a very simple analogy how I explain it and the framework we try to solve the problem. And I always describe, if you do troubleshooting with an observability tool, which is essentially what you at one point want to do, right? There's a problem and you want to troubleshoot. It is a bit like finding a needle in the haystack, right? That's kind of, you have a lot of data and you're finding the data that shows you, that's called the root cause, right? What's the root cause? It's the needle in the haystack. And I think what most of the vendors did, including myself in the past, we made the haystack bigger.
More data.
More data, right? Yeah. More data. And we did not really help solving the problem, to be honest. I think out there, and there's a lot of talks about AI and things, but if you look at most of the vendors, it's still very hard for developers to find the needle in the haystack, right? And so we came up with a framework how we want to tackle that, and we call it RIFT, R-I-F-T, and R stands for remove. That's a big thing. I think we should make the haystack as small as possible, right? Everything that you don't need, you should throw away as soon as possible, right? Which is kind of against most of the pricing models that are out there, right? That's one of the big issues, but I do think that you should not keep logs or traces that you don't care, right? And as an example, we just introduced a feature, we call it the telemetry spam filter, which works very much like a spam filter in your mail. If you see a log and you say, oh, this log is useless, right? Or you see a trace and it's just a ping to a service, which just looks at the health, you can click on it and say spam, and we will create a filter, and all those traces will not be collected anymore. Right?
That's really nice.
So a very simple thing to support users, which is a little bit, I can tell you as a vendor, it's a little bit, even now that we are early, it's a little bit scary, right? Because people pay for the number of logs and traces, and now you have people already paying and say, oh, if I release this feature, there's a high chance that, I don't know, people will remove 20-30% of the data, so I make 20-30% less money, right? That's number one. So it's R, remove data. And I think you can do it, again, think about, at the moment, it's a very simple feature. Users click, we generate a rule. But now what we are doing, we train a model in the background with all the user-generated rules. And similar to a spam filter in your Google Mail, I think over time we will learn what is actually spam and not, and we can automatically remove the spam for you, right? So removing data, sampling data, is a big topic for us. Because I think making the haystack smaller is in any sense good. You have less data, less things that you, I mean, again, the mail, if you would have all the spam in your inbox and you search for something, you get all the spam mail in your search results, right? Which you don't want. So finding the needle in a haystack is easier in small haystacks, right? And then in Rift is improve the data. And there we have multiple things that we are doing. As an example, we released our log AI. If you send us an unstructured log, we structure it for you. And in this case, we really use an LLM. So we use an LLM to analyze a log. Think about you send us an Nginx log file. And you know, it's the first three is the HTTP status code. So you get something like 200 URL. And then a number like 7,000, which is the response time in milliseconds. If it's unstructured, it's just text. Yes, you can search for 200, but what we will do is we will actually understand that the 200 is the HTTP status code, and we will translate that in the semantic convention http.status_code 200. And now what you can do, you can just filter by saying, give me everything that's an error. And we know 200 is not an error, 200 is okay. And we can filter it out. So by adding more semantics to the data, structuring it, or for example, at metrics, just figuring out what kind of a metric is it? Is it milliseconds or is it a number, a count?
Yeah.
And by adding that to the metric, that context, for example, if you put it on a chart, we can select the right chart for you because we know if it's milliseconds, it could be a different chart than if it's a gauche, right? These things we add. So this is the improve part, and we are adding more and more functionality to understand patterns, to do these things. That's the second part where we want to really distinguish ourselves from the rest. And sorry, if you have a question, just...
Yeah, just a quick tangent here. The thing you're doing with the log AI, it sounds incredibly expensive, right? If you are looking at all the logs, is it like yet you are generating a rewrite rule or like a regex that is parsing out the fields?
It's 100% correct. We also had a few posts around it. Also, when you look for AI engineers, that there are different types of AI engineers. You have AI engineers who can do something with Python and create you or use the LLMs, but then I can see that you work with performance. Then if you have billions of logs, you can't call the OpenAI API for each log and say, hey, look at this log, right? It's impossible. It's too expensive to do that. So what we essentially do, we generate a regex.
Via LLM.
Via LLM.
Yeah, and that takes out the field.
On the logs, we apply the regex, right? Because we can't apply the LLM on each log. Exactly. But this is something you really have to figure out over time, right? You figure out, oh, LLM works well, but then you figure out, oh, but I can't really apply it in production because it would be just too expensive, right?
Yeah. I will let you go further in just a second, but just yesterday I listened to the podcast, and for the first time, the insanity of the inefficiency of LLMs really, I understood this, right? Because like what you're actually doing is you have this kind of 10 billions or hundreds of billions of neurons, which is this gigantic amount of memory, like gigabytes of memory that you need to load. And then essentially you are visiting all of these memory points once, do a multiplication, and then you are arriving at the very end at one token. And every time you are ingesting a token, you are all doing this again. And a big part of the cost is really reloading all the stuff like gigabytes and gigabytes of data into the graphic card. And then comparing this to, okay, I have like a regular expression that I'm executing on the CPU. It's like so many orders of magnitude of efficiency that is standing in between this and this trend of, okay, let me throw an LLM on it. It's surprisingly effective, but you kind of begin to understand why it's so eye-watering expensive, because what you are actually doing is just so, it's pretty insane.
Absolutely, absolutely. But there are, I mean, if you are interested, because I'm also a performance guy, there is this idea of liquid neural networks. I'm not sure if you heard of it.
No,
it's an MIT research, and they are basically reducing the number of neurons you need incredibly, right? So I would say I can see that over time, similar to what I said with index or something, today you can call an LLM for each lock. Maybe in 2-3 years, it will be possible, right? But I agree with you. The inefficiency is, I heard the chief scientist of Facebook, he compared the current model, and the human brain is around 20 watts.
Yeah.
And none of the LLMs has the power of a human brain, but they consume, I don't know what it was, right? For one request, how many megawatts you need. And then he compared like 20 watts against this, the power that you need to use an LLM. It's so the human brain is magnitudes more efficient than anything that we have today, right? That's also an interesting comparison.
Yeah.
But sounds like they need a performance engineer.
Absolutely. But I think it's also normal. I think it is super normal that things are very inefficient at the beginning. And then you can see orders of magnitudes in performance gains over time, because then you, and I do think that we will see that here, right? It's already happening. And I can see that in the future, probably you can actually do that for every log, right? But at the moment, as I said, we need to build something that works on large amounts of data, and that's, at the moment, it would be super inefficient. Yeah,
I think you stopped at the eye of the Rift strategy.
Exactly.
I just wait until the end of the Rift, but now we interrupted in the middle.
Absolutely.
When I look at reduce, you know, I think if there is some methodology to have spam filters, I would immediately think, okay, now I can log more. You know, I don't have to. You reduce with the spam filters the price, but very often we are limited. You know, people say, you just cannot log as much as deep because the cost is too high. But now I hear, with the same cost, I get more or higher quality because I can add more logs.
We are not there yet, but finally, I would say yes. Finally, if our system would perfectly work, right? And as I said, at the moment, it's a manual thing where you reduce. But think about a world where you could log and send whatever you want, and the system will filter it for you and figure out the things and also reduce the things, because sometimes it's also, you can reduce things by creating a metric. So for example, maybe you have thousands of logs that are all the same. And at that time you could say, okay, I drop all the logs. I keep only one, but I have another metric which counts how many times I have this log, and you still have a lot of information. You have one log and I can tell you, and by the way, this thing came up 100,000 times in this time frame, right? So I think if you have more and more intelligence on the R part, right? And we are at the beginning here, then you could send as many data as you want, and we would only keep the relevant data, right? Which is, it sounds easy, but you can imagine it's actually pretty hard, because you somehow have to predict which data you would need to find the problem, right? But I would estimate that today, if you log things and if you look at data, and I see it with a lot of customers, there is a lot of garbage. I mean, obvious garbage. In the data, which you can really drop.
I mean, I remember a long time ago, I wrote a logger, my own logger, and the logger worked, you know, it logged very detailed, but you have lots of very detailed statements, but they are not logged yet. There was kind of a buffer in between. And if you have an exception, all the things from the buffer are written into the log. If you don't have an exception, if the thing runs through, you know, no logs. And that would be something which, you know, would be really cool to have. You know, I don't want to write this by myself. Right?
And by the way, in again, coming back to OpenTelemetry, the cool thing about the system is that you have the collector, and the collector is in different levels, right? It can run inside of a pod, it can run on your inside of your cloud, and it can run on our side. And so you have options where to drop things, which is the interesting. You have these things like tail sampling, where you sample at the end, but you could also drop metrics, as you said, you could have a buffer inside of the process or next to the process, keep data there, and then depending on some status codes, you could drop it there, right? That's why what we produce with the spam filter is something called OTTL, which is the language that you can use inside of the collector to decide if you keep or drop the data. And you could deploy that OTTL, that rule, either on our side, so the data is already produced and sent to us, but you could also use the same rule inside of the pod. And then it will be never sent to us. We will never see it, and you drop it earlier. So I totally agree with you, but which shows how that it's a more complicated topic, which can become pretty complex. But if you write a system that can do that efficiently and smart, I think that it's super powerful, right? And a big benefit in terms of price and cost, but also a big benefit in reducing the hay and finding problems more easily.
That might actually address a knot that I had in my head when you said, well, we have an automated spam detector. I was like, and what if that spam detector detects something that after the next application release is not spam anymore, or it detects a new log line that after the release is actually relevant. So what you just said is if it's a configuration within the collector, we could also like mark these as don't recognize these for like 30 minutes or an hour and activate them later.
It can become pretty sophisticated. But I do think that removing data is a big part, and I mean, there are actually categories of tools. If you know Cribble is now, I think they posted that's a 300 million ARR company. So it's a pretty big company, billions of dollars worth. That's a company that basically builds a tool that sits in front of observability and logging tools and removes data.
Yeah, nice.
So their whole kind of concept was, and they started with Splunk. So they said, hey, I think they were Splunk employees, right? And they saw, my customers actually sent millions of dollars of data into Splunk, and a lot of that is absolutely useless. So we built, and Splunk will never build something to reduce the data, because why would they, right?
Yeah.
And so they built a company where the only use case is, by the way, we save you 30% of the cost of Splunk, and you pay only 10%, so it's a good deal for both, right? So that's a whole category, and there are now like four or five different vendors out there that only do that. That's called observability pipelines these days. But it's essentially removing data.
It's interesting. I thought it's not on vogue at all anymore. I mean, people are using Splunk since, well, I would say decades, but I don't know like how long Splunk actually is around. I've used it in 2012, I think. They are using it to connect observability data with business metrics every now and so often, which I wouldn't say it's pretty reliable, but anyways. But like, if you want to do that, of course, I mean, your strategy fills up because or works because you want to have proper data that is reliable, so improved data.
Yeah,
and you want to make sure that you can base on that. The same goes for the data that I use to, for example, train my AI models.
Yeah.
That reminds me of the medallion architecture that Databricks is advocating for, like improving the quality of the data so that you can actually make something of it. But when you go on with the Rift strategy, maybe, would you mind to elaborate, like whether you already target LLM-based applications LLM-based tracing?
Yes. Cool. So just shortly, the FT stands for filter and triage. And filter, essentially, again, coming back to the haystack, filters away all the data that's irrelevant for your troubleshooting case. So you make the haystack even smaller. So remove data, improve the data. And if you have improved data, you can better filter the data. Example, coming back to my example, if you understand that it's actually a status code and you search for an error, you can remove all the 200s because that's probably not what you are looking at, but you keep the 500s and the 400s, right? And then the last is triage, which we also released this week. And it's essentially then pinpointing you to the relevant data. And what we do there is it's really not easy to explain. You have to experience it. We designed the feature and we were not sure if it's working, but once we had it, it's mind-blowing. So essentially, you mark something in a chart and you say, oh, this looks suspicious. And what we then do is we take the data that you marked inside of the bubble and compare it to data outside of the bubble, right, that you marked. And we have different algorithms for that. And then what we then do is we show you the differences. So think about you mark 10 errors, then we will tell you, oh, by the way, for that 10 errors, it's always that customer ID that's in there. And in the ones that don't have an error, it's not that customer ID, right? That's kind of the thing we do. It's not AI or something. It's really just comparing large amount of data statistically and giving you the result. And it's remarkable good at doing that.
Yeah.
And just one point, what I also want to say, that's why we don't call it root cause. I read a blog from Google, which essentially explained why if you search for something, you should not present only one result. And that was kind of mind-blowing for me. And this happened a few weeks ago that I understood it. So they said people always try to give you only one result, right? If you say root cause, they want to say this is the problem, right? But the way Google learned is, it is good if the first result is the problem, but if it's not the first result and you present a second, a third, and a fourth, and the user finds the result in that once, they are still happy. If you only present one result, so think about Google search would only represent the first hit. Mm-hmm. In 90% of the case, it would be exactly what you were searching for. You would be happy. But if in 10% it's the wrong result, you would be very unhappy with the experience, right? And so so what we do is we don't show you only one. We really show you a ranked list of problems, and you can essentially look at all of them, right?
I mean, I find it interesting to say the root cause. We mentioned Netflix. Lots of Netflix guys who were in the chaos engineering space there, they always talk about there is no single root cause in a complex adaptive system. It just doesn't exist, right? There are always more things, and
I thought it's always DNS, but
yeah, but I think that's a really cool feature. I heard about this idea not a long time ago, maybe 2 years ago. It's a long time in software. But I think Alex Hidalgo, he also once, you know, was thinking about this. And I was like, this is what you want to have. So it's good to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you have to make it easy, right, for the user. Yeah. That's something that makes it a little bit tricky, right? Like, again, like the spam filter, just one click and that's kind of applying the learning, which I said before, right? You can have very complex technology if you don't make it usable, right? So maybe a spam filter is just super simple and it works in 80% of the use cases and you just ignore the other 20%. It's still helpful, right? That's kind of the approach that we are taking here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you allowing to connect the trace data, for example, or the data generally in Dash0 to, for example, business metrics?
It's a big topic. Not yet. I think it's one of the things that I really want to do. And we have a clear opinion also how we want to do it, but we don't have it yet. No. And I really want to connect
philosophy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Based on open telemetry and based on all the telemetry, right? I can think about, you see a span, a call to something like, I don't know, a call to a checkout service. And that includes all the data, what's checked out, the revenue. And then I really think about having just one click and you create the metric like revenue, right? And now you have the metric on the dashboard, but it's actually connected to all the spans, which allow you, if you have a drop in your business metrics or revenue drops, you can directly connect it with the data to find the root cause. For example, it could tell you, but by the way, these spans now have an error because the database is broken, right? So you have a connection between your revenue drop and the database problem right away. So I do think that connecting business metrics with the underlying OpenTelemetry data makes a ton of sense, right? A ton of sense. And that's something we don't have that yet. We also haven't started building that, but I mean, this would be like the thing I want to build, yes.
Yeah, one thing that really impressed me when I looked at the DeshZero demo was how opinionated it was and how much like value was built in. So if you are onboarding, you are directly kind of seeing like things in a perspective that is helpful. And yeah, for example, like the service graphs are built out and then you have the red methodology to look at the APIs and the use methodology. I kind of saw some of this with the resource kind of metrics you're correlating. So I think that is a very important tenet for specifically like the onboarding experience, like zero to value, but also zero to how much value. If you have like, if you are selling a Swiss Army knife, then it's really like, okay, you can probably kind of engineer a lot if you are investing like a few months of time. But I felt like the out of the box value is pretty good. And also, given that it's a really new product, I was impressed by the level of polish that some of the features have. It was really like, okay, I remember running into this problem and we talked to a PM and half a year later we have it. And now it's like, well, you can already add attributes to the table and then it's just there. So can you maybe talk a little bit about your kind of product management strategy behind it and like your kind of approach? Like apparently you didn't follow the release early and iterate strategy, but to put some more color into this, I think I'm not really sure if you classify as a technical founder, but technical founders struggle a lot with exactly this, like the value proposition and the product management aspects.
I think there are multiple aspects of it, and I will try to explain them. First, why I'm a big believer in releasing fast and iterating with customers, but I didn't do that here for the first iteration because we are in a red ocean market. If you start in a blue ocean market, so if you don't have too much competition and if it's not an established market, you can start very early with an MVP and people will just love it and start. But in our case, if you have a Datadog, if you have a Grafana, if you have other competitors, if you start with a crappy product, people can compare it with existing tools and they will not accept it, right? That's just my experience I have. So I said, we have to start with what I called a minimal lovable product. So it should be minimal, but at least it should be lovable, right? And then coming to the topic of, yes, these little things, like I love the thing that you can take every tag and make it a column in the table and these things, right? And make everything filterable. And I think that's a culture thing. I really believe that the only way you can achieve that level of details and functionality is by making sure that the whole organization cares, and especially the developers. Because I saw this a lot also in Instana and other companies, that if you have product managers, if you have designers, at some point developers don't really feel responsible anymore for the quality what they are building, because they say, I'm just doing what I got in Figma, right? And then sometimes I really had this moment at Instana, I have to share this, right? I shared it publicly, where I came across Ben. Ben was working, a programmer. He's now the CTO, was our best programmer. And I looked at his screen. I saw, this looks like Instana, but it's different, right? And I looked at it and said, what is this, right? Is it in the future? And then he said, no, I built my own dashboarding system because I don't want to use the dashboarding instead of Asana, right? And I was like, why? Yeah, he said, because it's clunky, it doesn't work. And I like, what the fuck, right? Why don't you fix this thing inside of Instana for all of our customers, because they can build what you did, right? And so I was really mad, but I felt that it's actually a culture problem, because somehow the developers had the feeling that they can't change the things, that they can't build a product they love, and they were just doing what the product managers were telling them, which were not developers and couldn't feel the pain probably, right? And so you have to establish a culture where you have to really ask for it, right? That's the difference. I think if you just say, hey, we are an open culture, blah, 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 developers are just not all developers, but a lot of developers are not that vocal, right? And then you really have to make sure that you have a process and you have meetings where you ask for feedback, where you ask, like, is that something you want to have? What would you change? And you have to integrate them in the whole process. And that's what we do, I think, pretty well at Dash Zero, that we integrate the whole team in the process of designing features and making sure that we like it, right? Everything is keyboard usable because developers love the keyboard, and we look at that it's really working well, right? And it's little details. And the only way you can do that is by making sure that everyone in the organization cares, right? Including myself, right? I look at things, I test them, that's kind of one thing. And then the other I have to add is that we have a very high ratio of designers to developers.
So you have a lot of like designer and product managers as well, but design
product managers, we have really good ones, but we have much more designers than product managers. Nice. So our ratio is around 6 to 8 developers for one designer, right? Yeah. Where I think the average in the industry is 40 developers on a designer.
Yeah.
Right. And the really best ones is around 1 to 8. And I think this ratio of 1 to 8, 1 to 6 is really, really good. Right. And you have to find people that are designers and UX people who also understand the domain. Right. It is very hard to have a kind of web designer who doesn't know what a container is and a pod and Kubernetes. Every designer has to learn PromQL so they understand query language, and they have to kind of understand the concepts. And you have to give them time to learn them, that they become really good at designing and working with the developers, speak the same language. So I think that's a combination of how we try to make sure that the product really is opinionated, as you said, right?
Yeah.
That's also a point, but also kind of lovable and cares about details.
Yeah, I mean, I was impressed. So thank you for doing this. And I think this... if you start with the right culture, I think it's kind of self-propelling. But if you are having a different culture, then kind of changing it to the place where you need to be to build an amazing product, that's a much harder journey. But I like the focus of UX design. And then I think observability and telemetry is special since it has so much of a dogfooding aspect to it, right? Yeah. A lot of the developers, they understand the product on a deep level. And conversely, a product person coming in has always the struggles. So maybe like keeping the product management more in the technical hands, but having a lot of designers who are then making this really compelling and making it smooth, I think that's very, very interesting.
It's also something I always tell my team is like, it's a really rare case where you as a developer are also... the audience. Primary user of the tool that you are building, right? Yeah. I mean, that's kind of a big privilege, right? If you build an online banking, you're also kind of a user, but not the user. But in our case, our developers are like the perfect fit. And we as Dash Zero are also a perfect fit as a customer for our own tool, right? Yeah. So it's like we are building a tool for ourselves somehow.
Nice.
Yeah. Ach yeah. I'm feeling now... I currently use a product which can do everything. It's in the Gartner quadrant. It's, you know, very right up. And the problem is nobody is using it because it's too complex. I think I'm the only person because I'm the owner of the topic. But I think that simple, to offer simple tooling, you know, easy to use, that's so important. Yeah.
Yeah, but also it's also, again, coming back to my initial, this is probably also a good way of finishing up this thing, right? Coming back to the initial idea was that things are changing. And there's another thing that I learned, and I like to compare it. I in 2001, I was attending a conference in Boston called the Server Side Conference. I don't know if you remember the Server Side. It was a big website for Java technologies. And I had breakfast.
Which became InfoQ later.
The InfoQ guy
stole it. Yeah, exactly.
And so I was sitting at the breakfast in the hotel with a young guy in a white t-shirt, and the t-shirt had Jira on it, and it was Mike Cannon Brooks, and he released Jira 1 at the conference, right? And I learned about Jira and every open source. At that time, Bugzilla was the big thing, right? And Jira was so much nicer, right? The usability was nice. It was so, it's such a great tool, right? And every developer wanted to use it, right? And that's a story in 2001. 2025, I think if I tell my developers we will use Jira, they will all quit their job, right? Because it has become a bloated, large enterprise tool, and they do billions of dollars of revenue. It's a great tool, but it's an enterprise tool now, right? And I think that's kind of what happens. And now you have Linear, which is the smaller, good usability, opinionated tool, which is nice. But the reality is, if they are super successful and they will grow, they will get more enterprise customers and they will add more features for them because they spend millions of dollars with you. And in 10 years, it will be the next Jira, right? That's just, and that's the same in observability, right? You can start as the cool kid on the block. And then over time, if you get more enterprise customers and more features, you will get more complicated. And I haven't found a solution for that, to be honest. I think it's just the way things work. Right. It's if you are successful and you grow into enterprises, I think it's really hard to keep your opinionated focus on value on the core use cases.
Yeah.
And it just becomes an enterprise tool, and then the smaller customers and the cool kids will not use it anymore. Right. That's just I don't know if you have an idea about a solution for that, but I think it's kind of a little bit, it's not even the innovator's dilemma. It's the dilemma of becoming successful and catering the large enterprises of the world who at the end give you the budget that you need to grow as a company, right? That's kind of the way I see it. And that's, again, if you are in the magic quadrant in the top right corner, you are probably in the enterprise space, and then your product gets more complicated, right? That's just the reality of it.
Yeah, I think so, nice thing, sorry, is just to have somebody break into this market, right? With observability, it's really like this. You have like established player, which also like Datadog examples that just started extracting a lot of money, and they have so much advantage that it's really hard to catch up. And I think we're seeing something unique where you were able to position a product which is already competitive at a very early stage, and you were able to kind of leverage some of the advantages, most notably OpenTelemetry. On the technical side, I heard you're a ClickHouse user.
Yes.
Yeah. Which I think is also a big step up. Former company, we had to write our own time series database. That was a little bit of a drag. Basically, it was half the engineering team that was keeping that alive. So it's extremely good to see that there are new players. There's obviously kind of the risk that IBM will grab it, or a Splunk will grab it, or Cisco will grab it. I don't know. So as a like market participant, I hope you stay independent for a while. But I think that's just an example of a development where it kind of gets interesting again. And maybe in other situations, there's also hope, but it's like, it's never clear if we will see this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can tell you that this time I really want to stay independent, also because I learned that selling the company and not having the company anymore is not enjoyable, right? So yeah. I'm really enjoying the way, and I want to take it a little bit further this time. Yes.
Nice.
Hopefully not becoming, or I would love to become the next Jira, to be very fair, right? I mean, it's super successful. I think what Mike and Brooks is now the richest Australian, right? They are super successful with what they have built. Mm-hmm. But I would love to build this tool first to be a really super usable, lovable observability tool that solves the problem that I mentioned. And that would be fun. Yeah.
I would like to go back to your previous to last statement regarding the tool set. The meta statement that I took from that is basically that you said, well, if a tool becomes successful, it will grow more features because it wants to attract even more users. And then it's not clean and slim and focused anymore. So the meta statement that I get from that is, actually, it's totally normal that tools cannot make more than a few of the waves that you defined earlier, because at a certain point in time, they grow so big that they can hardly make the change.
Exactly. And then it really depends how long you survive. It really depends on the integration level into the stack of the customer. So how painful is it to remove? To say SAP survived so long because you can't remove it. Yeah, but you can, okay. But you also can't remove it, right? It would be just too expensive to remove it. So you can basically become such an enterprisey. The UI is maybe not that good. You have thousands of tables, which are complicated, but it's not replaceable easily, right? But if you are a tool like, task management, I'm not sure if it's a good example, right? But if you are a tool that's not so integrated, right, and it's easier to remove, I think there is a much higher chance that you will get disrupted. And in the observability space, you can see that, right? When I started, it was Wiley Interscope, right? Wiley Interscope, I don't know if it exists anymore, right? And the founder founded New Relic afterward, Lou Cern, right? And New Relic now is PE Play. They are still around, but who knows, right? And then there's AppDynamics, right? I worked with them, and AppDynamics got bought by Cisco, and then now they bought Splunk, and Splunk bought SignalFX. So I you know what I mean? I think it's a constant wave that every 5 to 10 years, the tools that were there 10 years ago either do not exist anymore, or there is a new wave starting. So to answer your question, I really think that's the case. Not only in observability, it's the same in security, in developer tools, in which toolset you used 20 years ago, not so much from the application server stack and IDEs and everything. Most of that became, again, Eclipse. I remember when I used the first version, it was so small and nice to use, and then over time it became bigger and bigger and bigger and more, you know what I mean? And then it was like the visual age for Java that I hated before.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. It was fat and ugly before.
Exactly.
I mean, don't want to be like,
no, it was the same guy, right? Like, Eric Gamma built Visual Age for before, and then he built Eclipse, and then...
But he had product managers around him, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
So that's the... I think it's just natural that things... I mean, I would love to say that I have the formula to prevent that, to become big and stay nice, and it's hard. Yeah.
Let's assume for a second that someone made it through the 1 hour 38 minutes to listen to our conversation, and they are a developer that had an idea for a little software, a little tool that actually solved a problem of their team, but they don't know how to start a business out of it. Mm-hmm. What would you recommend to that person? How should they start it, or what to consider actually?
I mean, first of all, I can say I did more than 80 angel investment, and I invested mostly in developers, right, as founders. And I saw very different types of people who are very introvert, had no idea of business, and they totally succeeded, right? So what I can just tell you as a paradigm is that there is not such a thing like a good startup founder that is an extrovert, or you can't see that. I know that a founder of UiPath, I met him very early, Daniel Danes, who is now a billionaire and a nice company. And when I met him the first time, he was really like this nerdy, couldn't speak English very well, right? And I know he took lessons afterwards in English and also from actors to be on the stage and how to present himself. I read the same about Martin Fowler, right? That he did a lot of acting lessons to feel comfortable on stages. And so what I want to say is, I think being an engineer is kind of a gift in if you want to build a company around software, because the core is the product, right? And everything else, you can find good people who will help you with that, right? Who will help you with marketing, sales, building a great company. So I love to invest in good engineers. So my recommendation would be, if you have an idea for something that really solves a problem, just go for it, right? I mean, it has become so easy, right? These days, think about 20 years ago, right? You would have to buy servers to build something. These days, you can start in the cloud. As a startup, you get like $100,000 of free AWS or free Google Cloud. So you can basically, for 1 or 2 years, you can work for free in the cloud. You have all the infrastructure. You have all the tools. It is so easy to build a software company these days. And then there's a lot of money out there, investors who are looking for you. There's AI. I mean, I just love the space and the time at the moment. I just think you can just do it, right? With the only thing I can tell you is saying for myself, it is much easier if you're young to do that than when you become older. Not because you're older means that you have probably kids, you have a house to pay, and the risk for you is much higher. Where when you are 24 out of university and you lived in a dorm anyways and you need $500 a month for a living, the risk what you are losing is so much lower than if you know what I mean? So it's always, so I can't do a general recommendation because it's always, there's a high chance that you will fail, right? If you build something like that. And then again, if you are 24 and you spend two years in building a software and you fail, what have you lost? Nothing, right? You gained a lot of knowledge, a lot of experience. But if you are 50, like myself, almost 50, and you have a house and kids and you waste 3 years of your life and...
Maybe you would try harder then if you have bills to pay.
Yeah, maybe you do. But it's not always that I don't have the feeling that money problems are actually a good motivation to become better. They are normally, I can say for myself, totally when I founded Codecentric, when you have some problems not knowing how you pay the next mortgage or something, that's not nice, right? It's really not nice. So I can't recommend that, right? So that's why I also recommend VCs that they take care of that, right? If people like who are more established found a company, they should make sure that they are financed in a way that they can get a good salary and have that security somehow, because it's something different if you are, again, 24 and 48, the double the age, you are in a different setting, right? So, but this said, I think the opportunity for software companies has never been so good. So my recommendation, just go for it, right?
Okay. And the, like, legal consulting and things like that, they could, for example, get from a VC. I mean, you've been moaning about the bureaucracy topic quite a bit. Yeah. So that might actually turn people away from founding.
Absolutely. So there are two learnings, and I can't give legal advice here, right? But I have to say that I think the risk is very low, right? The number of people who founded a company and are a general manager and end up in jail or anything is almost close to zero if you don't do anything really illegal, which you should. I mean, not doing something where you didn't know that you have to do it. I mean, something really bad, right? Then like Wirecard bad, right? Then you can end up in jail. But if you do normal business and you do everything and you have your tax consultant, right, and maybe a lawyer or something, then I don't think that the risk is really high. Yes, there's some bureaucracy. Yes, I agree. But yeah, you can. It's handleable, right? It's not that that big. So the risk is not that high, right? But if you would read a book, what the risk for a general manager are, you would probably never found a company, right? Because it's there is a lot of risk, but the reality is that nobody will end up in jail because you filed the tax too late or whatever, right? That's just not the case. Yeah.
Mirko, it's been a pleasure, I have to say. And time flies. Is there anything that you would like to say as the last words for this podcast?
No, thank you for having me. It was really fun. I appreciate all your knowledge in this space, to be honest. It was a really deep discussion from kernel level up there. That's that was really fun. And yeah, looking forward to hear more episodes in the future from you.
Thanks a lot. And yeah, any last words from you, Sven or Heinrich?
Thank you, Mirko. This was amazing.
Yeah. I had a lot of more questions, but in the middle, I thought if we go deeper and deeper and deeper, you know, we end up with 6 hours or something like that.
A very nerdy long term.
Yeah, I mean,
the good thing is actually that Sven and Heinrich and myself can keep the questions because we know that Ben Blackmore, your CTO, also said that he would love to join the podcast conversation, and we're really looking forward to this and maybe go even deeper, but let's see.
Absolutely. And Ben really is the best developer I've ever seen, so he's pound him, he's amazing.
Was he the one with the dashboard tool?
Yes.
Did this
ask him what he did.
And we will start with this.
And ask him about my reaction.
Okay. We will do. So then I say thanks a lot to you guys. And thanks a lot to everyone who's made it through the podcast so far. Thanks for listening. And hope to see you on the next episode. Have a good time.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.